really don't have anything to do with sound on film, but they've got such a great presentation that we found 40 minutes for them here in our program. So here we are. Scott Ellsworth was a creator and on-air host of Scott's Place that aired on KFI here in LA from 67 through 74. And it's a great honor to have Scott with us today. To introduce him and to tell us about Scott's Place is Phil Grice.
Grice.
Okay. I always get that confused. I'm sorry, Phil.
It's okay.
Phil is an Emmy Award-winning director of photography who maintains what must be the world's largest collection of audio air checks of television programming. His archival Television Audio Incorporated was accredited by Guinness World Records in 2002. And what that has to do with radio air checks in Scott's Place, I guess we're about ready to find out.
We're doing some radio today. All right. On May the 14th, 1997, and we're talking about exactly to the day, 14 years ago, Alan Glover, who was a curator at the time at the Museum of Television and Radio, now renamed the Paley Center for Media, he put me in touch with a person who was living in California. His name was Greg Hoffman. And it turned out that his late father had an audio air check collection, and I decided to solicit it, and I paid close to $1,000 to have a 960-pound crate delivered from California to New York. I found in this crate an assortment of material. I had air checks that would primarily represent television from 1956 to 1979. There was a huge amount of material that was basically taking LPs and ETs and transferring them over to audio tape. And to my discovery, in that cache of material, there were 155 reel-to-reel audio air checks of Scott's Place. And that was a radio broadcast hosted by Scott Ellsworth between March 30th, 1970 and April 1st, 1972. After monitoring a number of these audio air checks, and I had no clue as to what these were, I became really fascinated, and I realized that there was great value and historic importance to these shows. They were broadcast on KFI, 640 radio in Los Angeles, and what was amazing, and I later found out, that they were broadcast Monday through Saturday, 4 hours live each night, from midnight to 4 a.m. in the morning. And they were all devoted to one subject, jazz. I estimated approximately 550 broadcasts were aired during that two-year period of time. Let's take a little trip back with Scott, who I'll introduce in a moment, who's my guest here, and get a little feel for Scott's Place.
And good evening, everyone, and welcome to Scott's Place, the place where all the musicians gather to play their music and to talk about their music, talk about how they got started in the music business and why they play the instruments that they do, and some of the funny things that have happened, some of the sad things that have happened along the line. We have our fine, astute, and esteemed engineer and partner here at Scott's Place, Larry Maggiore. And so that basically is the theme and the feeling that we try to create here, just a relaxed atmosphere. Now, in the past, we've had such guests drop by as Sammy Nestico. Now, Sammy's the one who wrote the theme, Scott's Place, for it, for our show, and played for us by Mr. Count Basie.
The proprietor of Scott's Place, Scott Ellsworth, is respected and admired among the jazz artists, musicians, composers, arrangers, conductors, and vocalists. He's been a longtime preservationist of jazz music. His career is in broadcasting spans the early 1950s in New York City, later in Denver, Salt Lake City, and since 1965 in Los Angeles. He has also hosted radio and television talk shows, network newscasts, and has had a successful acting career on stage, in movies, and TV series. It is my really great pleasure to introduce my special guest, Scott Ellsworth.
Thank you very much. The thing that's most interesting to me, I was born in 1927, and if you were listening to the gentleman before us, that's when most of the things began in the world of broadcasting, 1927. It was during that period my father, who was a song plugger, you know what a song plugger is? Anyhow, he was a song plugger, and at that time he was working at KDKA in Pittsburgh, went from there up to New York City to NBC, where as time went on, I was able to meet with Walter Damrosch, or Nightbeat, to see them, and to admire the announcers who walked around, as you saw, in tuxedos and bow ties. This is the NBC network, right? Those were the good old days of radio. So then, later on, listening to all of this about making soundtracks for motion pictures and all, I taught that, not quite as, this was more of a PhD tonight. I was teaching elementary sound at Cal State Long Beach. And having spent many, many years in the studios in Los Angeles and listening to all of the jargon that he was passing our way, nags and mags and click tracks, I feel right at home. So anyhow, now let's go. Went to Los Angeles, and on a lark, I was doing a television show down the street from KFI, drove up Vermont Avenue, had never seen the KFI building, and I looked over and I saw the building as I was passing. I said, oh, I'll have to drop by sometime. There it is, and drop off my disc, got a 16-inch disc because it was cut in 1950. And you didn't have tapes around then. So I changed my mind. I said, I'm going to go back. I went back and went into the place and told the girl at the desk I wanted a job. She said, I'll get a hold of Pat Kelly, who was the program director. Went in, talked to Pat Kelly. Now, this is the strange thing. When I was in New York City, the chief announcer at NBC, who I knew very well, was also Pat Kelly. And he said, look, you want to get into the radio business, here's the NBC audition. You learn that thing, put it on a disc, and I'll give them to you. He gave me five, I think it was. And now I'm in Los Angeles, and I handed the disc to the new Pat Kelly. He said, nah, I don't trust those things. I want to know what you can do now. So he took me back into the big studio where they used to broadcast all of these wonderful radio shows. I was going to say Mork and Mindy, no. Way back when, and on the big stage there, he handed me what? The NBC audition. It was a snap. So I went through the medical jargon, the classical music jargon and all. Next thing I know, I've got a job. He said, when can you start? And I thought he was kidding me at first, but he wasn't. So that's how I got into KFI on a lark, and from there on it grew. Then, now, going back to NBC in New York City, about the 1968, all of your old-time radio aficionados will know, NBC was getting out of the radio business completely. Television was coming in. So what happened? In the door at KFI came Dave Garraway, Jazbo Collins, Robert Q. Lewis, and a bunch of other announcers and performers at NBC in New York looking for work. So they went there and stayed at KFI a very short time because this was not their cup of tea. Jazbo finally packed his bags, went up to San Francisco. Now, I had known Jazbo in New York City in the Purple Grotto. Remember the Purple Grotto? Huh? Anyhow, he said when he was leaving, hey, Scott, you know Jazz, you take over the show. And I said, okay, it's a deal. So I walked in, never said anything to the front office because they were glad that somebody was going to take over without them having to hire someone. So that's how it got started. I went home, got all of my jazz records, brought them in, and the brainstorm came, why not have musicians on the show? You're in the center of entertainment. You have all the great musicians, the composers, whatever. So I went on the air for about the first week or two talking about this is what I want to do. I'm hoping that I'll get a reaction from the audience and from musicians. Immediately, the phone began to ring. Musicians saying, hey, what a deal, man. I'll do that. I'll come down, you know, and plug my records and plug my shows. So eventually, I went to a party one time. Stan Kenton happened to be there. Got to know Stanley, and I mentioned it. He said, where do I go? When do I start? So he was my very first guest, Mr. Stan Kenton.
And that was March 30th, 1970.
1970. So we've gone from 23 or 27 to 1970. Okay.
Let's take a little listen to one of your very most notable guests. And we're going to listen to Mr. Woody Herman. This is from September 24th.
It's my turn to greet at our table Mr. Woody Herman. What a great pleasure it is to meet with you and talk to you, sir.
Well, thanks, Scott, and it's very nice to be here. I've heard your show several times. I don't get home too often.
So I found out.
Yeah.
What was the very first song that you ever sang and recorded? Do you recall?
Would you like to know the very first song I sang?
Yeah, okay.
Well, my first big number.
Yeah.
I was working in theaters when I was a little kid. I was 9 years old and I sang a song which I later recorded on Capitol under a phony name because I didn't have the courage. It was called OG Sagey, You Ought to See My Gigi from the Fiji Isles. Little Woodrow was swinging.
OG Sagey,
You
Ought to See My Gigi from the Fiji Isles. Gosh, G Sagey, You Ought to Be With Gigi. She can make it smile. She got rings inside her nose and bells upon her toes.
Now we're looking at 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday, midnight to 4 a.m., live. Scott has indicated to me, never missed a performance, never missed a show. KFI, regarding KFI, did they ever have any restrictions set upon you, especially in the initial weeks and months and first year?
No, because I guess I was young and daring and a little bit of a rebel. I never told them what I was doing. It was midnight. I knew that nobody was going to be up listening. So when I had Stan Kenton on, well, of course, the phone began to ring, and Kenton's buddies are now calling in from all over the city or whatever, the state, and they're saying, gee, I want to be with Stan. You know, I'll come in next week or whatever. So I never had to worry about a musician being, or a writer, being able to be on the show. Now, KFI was 50,000 watts clear channel, which meant that we covered all of the United States, especially at night. And a lot of times, I would have a call from, say, Kansas City. Vic Damone was one of the guys that did that. He was heading from New York back to L.A., going to be performing in L.A. And the phone rang, and it's Vic. And he said, hey, I'm listening to you out here in Kansas City. Any chance I get on the show? And I said, yeah. Name a date, and we'll do it. Because I had to work around all the musicians' schedules. They were all working, especially late night recording sessions and all. And that would happen quite often, where I'd get calls from outside. One thing that was beautiful, if you know anything about musicians, I hire you to be the trumpet player with my band. Comes a day for the recording, you're sick. You will get on the phone and bring in a substitute. If any musicians here know that fact, they always would do that. So if somebody had to suddenly not make the show, I would mention it on the air the day before, and in would come Billy Byers, remember Billy Byers, or Dick Nash. I mean, all of these great, wonderful people in the business.
Scott, one individual who was very paramount, very eminent, who graced your studio on November 12, 1970, had a request of you, something that you were not able to provide. Let's take a listen to a very, very unusual request at 2 o'clock in the morning. Mr. Duke Ellington.
Duke Ellington said when he came in, he said, I'm very hungry, and he said, I'd love something to eat. And here it is about 2 o'clock in the morning. And what was your request again? You wanted oysters on
the ham? Oh, no, I was asking, lady, if there was some place where they had oysters on the half shell, you know, fresh oysters. You being a gourmet and authority on this sort of thing, well, I thought maybe we'd come over and ask you, you know.
Oh, you thought that I would know. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, Slim Gaylord...
Well, somebody on within earshot might know.
One of... One of my very favorite stories that you related to me, Scott, was the morning, the early morning that Dave Garraway ambled into your boudoir theater and had a very strange request, even more strange in my opinion than the Duke. What was that, Scott?
Well, he came in. He had said, sure, I'll do the show. We had talked during the day, and I said, great, how about next Thursday or something? And he came in. Now he said, I have to tell you, Scott, I have a very bad back, so I can't sit in a chair. I'm going to have to lie on the floor. Well, I thought he was kidding me at first, but he wasn't. So he did. I'm sitting here, and now he's stretched out on the floor on his back. And I said, how'd you get into the business? That's the way the whole interview went. Dave was an off-the-wall guy, if any of you knew him or had anything to do with him. If you remember his Dave Garraway at Large, oh, what a fabulous... See, all of these people like Dave Garraway, they were all my role models. I wanted to grow up to be like them. Well, actually, I was about the same age as most of them, but that's beside the point.
Let's take a little listen to Dave on the floor.
I know after the radio days of MAQ, then you had the television show.
We were pretty entrenched in radio. We thought we had the world by the string. And the boss came in one day and said, fellas, they got this cable coming out from New York, and I got this wire here. And he handed me the wire, and it said, NBC Chicago, can you fill Sunday evening 9:30? NBC New York. And he said, you think you can do something in a half hour? And I said, well, I don't know. I wish I'd never heard the dirty word, but we'll try. Hope it doesn't get in the way of the radio rehearsals. After a while, you know, things change.
Where did the name Garraway at Large come from? Was it your own idea or someone?
No, it belonged, the idea began with a guy named Ted Mills, who was the producer.
As I started monitoring a lot of these air checks, I started to realize that there was a consistency with these shows where when an interview was going on, there was a really sweet, low-key background of din, like being at a nightclub. And there was a little bit of tinkle in the background, like Hoagie Carmichael might be playing a little something. This, I assume, was your concept, Scott, and it provided a very, very homey, very, very nurturing feeling.
Well, I had done a lot of work at CBS in L.A., and knew the sound people. So they gave me this wonderful disc of a nightclub sound, the people talking and the tinkling of glasses. So I would run that in the background during the show, and then I would put in somebody, George Shearing maybe, but in the background, so that it would sound like we were broadcasting live from Scott's place, which, to add to this, on occasion would happen, that the station would get a phone call and say, gee, we listened to that show last night. Where is this club? We'd love to go there. Well, it was up here is where it was.
One of my favorites, Scott. Let's take a listen to Harry Mills when he appeared with you on Scott's Place and some secret revelation.
And we are here with Mr. Harry Mills of the Mills Brothers.
Hi, Scott.
How are you? What a thrill. I would imagine that one would be able to say that the Mills Brothers were really barbershop quartet singers to begin with, because one of the brothers was a barber. It was Harry. No, you weren't.
No, Scott. Actually, our father owned a barber shop, and our father had a quartet in that barber shop. And we boys, John, my oldest brother, Herbert, Donald, my youngest brother, and myself, we sit around in the evening after school and used to hear them sing. Yeah. And we stole their harmony.
Did you?
My father and his other three friends in the barbershop.
I found an article about Scott. It was an article by Don Page, and I quote, he says, Scott Ellsworth prepares his shows a week in advance, lining up guests and going over the music. During the interviews, he tries to ask questions that the layman would ask. And he quotes Scott by indicating Scott would say, I don't like coming off as an all-knowing sophisticate. Now, what did you mean by that, Scott?
Well, like you could show off and say what a G7 is or whatever. No, you tell me what it is. You're the musician. I'm just the guy. You don't play dumb. But you play innocent, and that's the only way you get the good answers from the people. I think that that's the thing that made Merv Griffin so popular, because he always played, oh, did he really do that? I don't remember that. I suppose that was the thing in the back of my head. All the time, well, everything I do now even, is I want people to say, I didn't know that. You know, after they heard something, I didn't know that's the way that Count Basie did this and so on. Going back to, if we may, to the Duke and how that happened, Duke was in town. He was playing one of the big hotels there. Was it the Waldorf? No. The Ambassador Hotel. And he was finished at midnight or whenever it was, went up to his room, and his press agent was there in the room with him. And the radio was on. He said, who's that guy? What's this all about? And she mentioned it, and he said, hey, why don't I go down there and be on his show? Now, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't expect a Duke Ellington on the scene. And all of a sudden, he walked in the front door, and the gal, of course, brought him back to the studio. And I turned around, and here's the Duke, and his first words were, is this the place? Where's the food? And I'll never forget that.
Where are the oysters?
Where are the oysters, right?
Someone who was almost as old as Duke, very, very interesting individual. Let me throw something at everyone with regard to Mr. Al Rinker from the Rhythm Boys.
Right.
Al Rinker was one of the original Rhythm Boys, along with Harry Barris and another young fellow by the name of... what do they call him, Dare Bingle, something like that?
Bing
Crosby, that's Al Rinker.
As a matter of fact, the Rhythm Boys came a little later. Bing Crosby and I started out together from Spokane, and we were a duo before we were a trio. And, we're going back, clear back to 1925 when we drove down here in an old Model T Ford. But later on, in 1944, we had a reunion on... Paul Whiteman's show, the Chase and Sanborn show with Paul Whiteman, and it's the first time we've been together for 13 years. Play that now?
Yeah, let's play it, and have Paul Whiteman introduce it, Paul.
Well, you go right ahead, boys. Ladies and gentlemen, it's that much-loved bit of Americana, the Rhythm Boys, Mississippi Mud.
Here's Mud in your eye. What are you boys moaning about?
That Mississippi Mud.
Scott, so many individuals, especially in the business at the time, and you had related this to me, were very diffident and shy initially about even thinking about coming on your show. Now, you must have had a very, very ingratiating way to convince them that coming on was going to be fun. What was your technique?
Oh, I don't know. I would just try to... I would sign on my show at midnight, but the guests would not go on until 12:30. And during that period, I would sit and talk to the guy, you know, or girl, and make them feel at ease, let them see what I'm going to be doing. But now most of them had already heard interviews. They knew that I was not going to try and jab them about anything or try to make them embarrassed. Plus, they would, on occasion, come in with what did you call it? The Jackie Gleason.
The Jackie Gleason coffee, yeah, little of that.
So that by 4 o'clock in the morning, many of them were revealing stories that they may not have revealed otherwise. You know.
Now, just so that everyone is aware, Scott also left the studio confines from time to time, and he did specials. He hosted one time the Monterey Pop, the 14th annual, did a piece from Disneyland. Let's take a little listen.
Here we are at Disneyland, Dixieland and all that jazz, and all throughout this week, right up through Saturday, we've got Bob Crosby, Dizzy Gillespie, Earl Father Hines, Trummer Young, and the world's greatest jazz band appearing here. In fact, right now, seated across the table from us, we have Earl Father Hines himself. Welcome to KFI and to Disneyland, Earl.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here. And
well, this is the place. It's Scott's place, and to the combined facilities of radio stations KIDD here in Monterey and radio station KFI in Los Angeles, we do present the 14th annual Monterey Jazz Festival, and we have a list of fine performers lined up for you this morning. We're going to be talking to Jimmy Lyons and John Lewis, Louis Belson. We've got Doug Anderson and Ray Brown, all kinds of fine people. But right now, let's listen to one of the gentlemen who's appearing at the Monterey Jazz Festival, Mr. Dave Brubeck, and let's take five.
Things are going pretty smoothly, but there was a moment in time where KFI started to approach you and give you some little bit of a signal that maybe all was not that well. Mm-hmm. What did they, at that time, want you to change?
Well, they were usually, I call it bubblegum rock. Call it whatever you want to call it. And they wanted me to change my format from jazz to bubblegum rock. And I said, I don't want to do that. And they said, well, we'll have to think about it. Well, apparently they thought about it. And are you going to lead into?
Not yet.
The demise? Okay.
No.
So anyhow, that was about it. My last guest was the marvelous, wonderful Johnny Mercer. Sat with Johnny. He stayed all night long.
Let me curtail that towards the end when you actually get the axe.
Okay.
All right.
Sure.
I want to make it known. I'm looking through all of these air checks, and I have 155. There are also other air checks that Scott also was able to have recorded, very helter-skelter, and he donated his collection to the American Jazz Institute in Pasadena. Mark Masters is in charge of that, and they're right now in storage. One individual who was about to celebrate her 80th birthday on July 16th, still alive, one of the few from all of those past celebrities, Della Reese.
This is it. This is the place. It's Scott's Place right here on KFI for this Friday morning, June 19th, believe it or not. Oh, and look who just came in the front door. There she is. Della Reese. Della's going to be our guest here this morning at Scott's Place. We'll be talking to her and playing some of those fine recordings that she has. How did it all start?
Well, I was in Detroit. I'm from Detroit. And I was singing with a church. And they had a radio broadcast on Sunday nights. And they wanted to appeal to the young people. And I was six, and I could carry a tune. I wasn't scared to sing in public, you know. Those were my assets. I could remember a lyric, carry a tune, and I was bold enough to stand up in front of the congregation. So they wanted to show that there was a place in the church for children. And I wanted to do it, and I did. I had no idea, though, for years that you made money doing this. You know?
Some of the guests would come in, and maybe because of commitments, Scott, you would do a 75-minute interview segment. Others, the whole 4 hours. And I'm going to play a little clip from a 3.5-hour interview with Billy Eckstine and then ask you the question, what was the advantage of having the long format as opposed to the short? Mr. Billy Eckstine.
I think the greatest thing that, well, the thing that I carry with me, in fact, I don't have it tonight, but it's in my address book, and it was an interview that Ellington had with Earl Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, during the interview, they asked Duke of all of his songs that he has, and the different people who have recorded them. And the thing that flattened me, because it was sent to me, I wasn't there, and somebody sent it to me, he said, nobody sings my songs like thee. And boy, look, wait a minute. You know, that's pretty heavy.
You want valve trombone?
I'm on valve on this. No. And Gene Ammons is on tenor saxophone. And I think Fats Navarro, if I'm not mistaken, is on this too.
All right, let's put it all together now. Cool Breeze.
So, Scott, what were the advantages of having 3 hours, 4 hours, one guest?
Well, because they would open up the first couple of minutes or, say, half hour. They might be a little bit stiff. They're not used to musicians. They're used to playing a horn, you know, not talking. But eventually, even without the Jackie Gleason medicine, they would really begin to feel at ease, and they would talk more and more. And it gave you a chance, too, because, like with Duke Ellington, Woody Herman, because we opened up the show talking about the fact that he was never home. And later on in the show, he said, you know, I've been married 25 years, and I think we've only spent 2 years of 25 years together, you know, because he was always on the road.
From October 6, 1971... your moment with Oscar Peterson.
Mm. Wow.
Mr. Peterson, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Scott.
I hope that all meets with your agreement this morning. What I have done is I've gathered together a whole pile, and boy, when you start piling up Oscar Peterson records, you can go for days and days and days. But I've sort of gone in chronological order, and you may rearrange it as you see fit as we go along. But this first one, I believe, is one of the very first recordings that you made here in the United States when Norman Granz brought you down. And this is at the time when you were, as they say on the record, Oscar Peterson at the piano solo with rhythm accompaniment and a young man by the name of Ray Brown on bass. And Lover, Come Back to Me.
Scott, while you were doing this two-year stint series, at the time, did you think that you were basically providing a time capsule for the future, or it was just so contemporary and it was basically in the moment that it didn't conceive that we'd be together here in 2011 trying to get some of these very precious tracks, which now are so much more meaningful because of their scarcity.
No, to me, it was just a matter of I always had a great love for musicians. I was a would-be musician in my youth, played with territory bands around Jersey and things like that, but was never good enough to be able to compete with Harry James or whosoever. But I admired musicians so much, and it was always like a love affair, and it used to offend me no end that you would watch a movie, listen to the soundtrack, and here's this beautiful saxophone playing, you know, the scores to the movie, but never once did you know who it was. Until you wind up interviewing these guys, you find out that he was the saxophone player. And finally, he's getting recognition for what he did. Of course, he got paid well. But recognition to anybody is important, you know, to have people say, oh, I know you. You're the great trumpet player, or you're the great singer, whatever it might be. And I suppose it was, to me, if I were a sports fan, how would I feel to be able to sit all night long and talk to Lou Gehrig, you know, Babe Ruth, whoever it might be, and have them talking to me personally.
And also you asked the right questions that I was not aware of. Here's one. How many people realize what the first gig, the first job Mel Torme ever had? Well, listen to what Mel Torme said.
Yes, this is Mel Torme. And when I was talking to Mel prior to going on the air, Mel said, how come you're going to play all of my records? Why don't you let me play the records that I would like to play? And I tried to explain to Mel. I said, well, because there are so many Mel Torme fans out there that I'm sure that they would be offended if we didn't play Mel Torme records. We're also going to stick in some of your favorites. Good morning to you, Mel.
Morning. Morning, sir.
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 How about that? I have to invite him back.
Anybody that's crazy enough to play all those records of mine, I have to address as sir.
Well, let's go back to the time when you were working with some of the bands, and you were also performing with the bands, singing with the bands, and then you had the Meltones and so on, lumping it all together.
Well, the only band I ever actually sang with Scott was Chico Marx's band.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let
Chico
the name
Marx.
Kid you.
Remember Chico
I was 16
Marx?
Years old. And it wasn't that I was any good. It was just that I wasn't very draftable at the time.
Mm.
Hired by the Chico Marx Band in August of 1942.
Scott, occasionally, I have to give you tremendous credit because so many people never had the mindset to archive their own broadcasts. You did take the initiative, and you had told me yesterday that there were times where you'd go to your engineer and you would say, please record this. And then it was helter-skelter, 50%, 80% of the time they wouldn't do it. And is that the way you eventually came up with your own collection?
I would supply the tape. And it all depended upon the mood of the engineer. Now, those of you who have in the business dealing with engineers, they have their own world that they live in. And pardon me, engineers here. But anyhow, it never, it wasn't a gone conclusion that they would record the show. It was always disappointing that they didn't have, because we were separated. You know, we're in a big studio at NBC in Los Angeles. We're in one room and the engineers in the other room, so you don't know what they're doing or seeing what they're doing. They're listening to you, you think. Of course, we had some engineers on occasion who were also into Jackie Gleason's coffee. And you say, well, okay, listen to, what is it, track two? Yeah, listen, up would come track three. It's always embarrassing when you have the guests right there and they got the wrong track. Well, anyhow.
Super. All right, we're winding down. I would certainly want to take some Q&A, so let me just put on a few more and we're going to get to that. Here's clarinetist Barney Bagard.
Oh, my favorite.
to mix it up with Mr. Barney Bigard. That's it. The Dubaloo Gin.
Dubaloo Gin Stomp. That means a double gin.
Now, on April 1st, 1972, you probably did one of your most prolific broadcasts with Johnny Mercer. And you went home, you got into bed, and the phone rings around 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, and KFI management requests your presence. And you say, and you're kind of thinking, is this it? And they said, no, just come on in. So you got in your car and you went to KFI and?
And they said, you either play bubblegum rock or whatever, or you're out of here. Well, I was so mad because I'd asked him, I'm in bed, you know, I've been up all night long. Please tell me now, is this the end? Oh, no, 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 no. Well, I very seldom lose my temper, but I do mean I did. I cleared his desk, I cleared his bookshelves, his telephone, and I was just so mad that they would do that. You know, you have every right in the world to fire me for any reason you want to fire me, because it's your money. But speaking of money, that always impressed me, to be able to sit there with Barney Bigard and Duke Ellington and Count Basie and get paid good bucks at the same time and enjoy yourself. Wow. It was wonderful.
You had a lot of admirers from the industry. Here's one who actually says something that represents a lot of other people, including myself. And it was June Christie who came on the show towards the end.
I'm nervous. I really am. Don't ask me why. Hello, June.
Hi, Scott.
I thank you so much for dropping by.
Oh, it's my pleasure. If I had known that everybody was going to get spruced up, I would have done the same myself. It's my pleasure to be here, Scott, and I really feel that the visit that I owe you, because like so many people who are fond of jazz, we need you. And if I can do anything to support you, I'm here.
And I'm going to echo that sentiment. We did need you. I'm so appreciative that you were able to do what you had done. And this is over 40 years ago, and I salute you. And I would I would love, if I have a couple of moments, to take some questions from the audience.
Yeah, we do have time. And I'm just need to make one announcement. Silent auction does end at 11:15. So please get over there. If you need to do any business with any of the vendors, get over there. Not trying to get them out of your session, but just trying to let them know there's a clock ticking in the other room. But please stay, answer questions. You got a rapt audience here. All thanks.
Right. Rapt.
And as we ask questions, I'm throwing on Scott's Place theme, which was played by Count Basie. It was his theme for the last year. In the manner of how the programs were presented, questions and answers with Scott's theme in the background. Anybody have a question?
Yes,
for Scott?
I just walked out. I was very fortunate. Yes, I wound up doing a 2-month film down in the Virgin Islands. Yeah. So, for the 10 years I was doing the same show in Palm Springs every Saturday and Sunday until they sold the station last January 30th. And I was doing the same thing, basically, the music, interviews, enjoying myself.
Yes, sir.
Ron McCoy. I used to sit in for Ron. Yeah. Thank you. No, Ron was a wonderful gentleman, because whenever he would go on vacation, he'd call upon me to do the Night Owl show. Right.
Any other questions? I might add that Scott will never be out of work. He could double Charlton Heston anytime. Thank you, Scott, for coming down.
Thank you.